Hello and welcome to the first interview for A Shot of Cthulhu with myself, Kimber, and the APOC host, Matt. Today we're interviewing Andy Boyd for their game Midnight Muscadines. Thanks for being here today, Andy.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on here and chat.
Well, we're really excited to have you here. I know your life is a little busy right now, so we're super excited, honestly, and so grateful that you could take time out today.
Oh, not a problem. I love this is what I love to do. So I am happy to come geek out about, you know, something I've spent 4 months in a cave writing about. I finally get to go out and talk to people about it.
Only 4 months? Is that honestly how long it took? Is that it?
That's where it is at currently. So the story behind like where this came from was we were challenged on, I believe, Blue Sky by a couple of Drakes, Sean and Navi Drake. And RP of Fari RPGs was hosting a game jam for the Songs and Sagas game. And they pinged me and they were like, we should make a game together and it should be a jam-themed game. And I was like, you know what? We're in. Let's go. And there was a month left in the game jam. And so the first beta release was created in a month. And it was one of those where, you know, I was just using, you know, like public domain assets and free asset packs from itch.io. And then by the time I went to release it, I was like, no, this is going to be a big game. Like, this is a really cool game. I really like where this is going. And then I reached out to my artist and my editor, and I was like, I need everybody on board. Like, we're doing this thing. And yeah, so then 3 more months, and now we have a campaign. We have a January release version that is out to, you know, the public and press and things like that for people to look at and play. So yeah, it's been really fast.
That is super exciting. So there's a question. There's a question that gets asked of everybody that is interviewed by a pint of Cthulhu. And that is, if a pint of Cthulhu were a drink, what drink would it be?
Say that again. If a pint of Cthulhu was a drink?
Yes.
Yep. If it was a drink, what drink would it be?
Oh, I would say it would be a mixer with the drink chartreuse. Have you guys ever had chartreuse before?
I have not.
So it is an herbal distilled like liqueur, and it is bright green, but it is like mint and sage and, you know, all of these different herbs, and they're all distilled down. I think there's anise in there as well and a bunch of other things, but it's an herbal drink. And long time ago, a friend of mine used to be absolutely obsessed with it and would make like cocktails with it, and you could put it over rocks, right? It's only, I think it's like the same proof as like wine, so it's like fortified but nothing crazy. But it's bright green, like super bright green. So I'd probably make something with that or just have it over rocks, because it will put hair on your chest or take it off depending on the application, kind of like flavoring to it. It's a very intense flavor. It's very good. So yeah, something with chartreuse.
That sounds interesting.
Just a bit.
Yeah.
So Andrew, tell us a bit about yourself.
Oh, so obviously my name's Andy Boyd. Let's see. I just went full time with game design in January. Spent 3 years making Pandion games and making games and game design and things like that. But during that time, before that, I'm an IT specialist, so I do like systems administration for K-12, higher education, places like that, universities and colleges. And I've worked in Illinois and North Carolina and South Carolina and all sorts of places. But, you know, now I was able to finally go full-time with writing, which is my passion, writing and game design and storytelling and stuff like that. But I'm originally from Illinois, moved to North Carolina fresh out of college, because we got offered a job to move down there. And then we've kind of been in the South since. And now we're looking to move back up to the Midwest. So that's what we're working on right now. And yeah, it's been great. It's been a crazy 3 years, to say the least. I still don't believe this is, you know, real life, that people are actually reading and playing our games. It's surreal.
Cool. So you talked about how the game has come about, which mm-hmm. which is pretty awesome. But can you describe like the game itself and some of its like its core mechanics and how they differ from other TTRPGs?
Yeah, so Midnight Muscadines, the core concept is you exist within the world of a shattered sun. There are beacons of light that illuminate a small patch of the world that's left. And you are marmoteers. You are collectors of the Midnight Muscadine, which is the last source of magic in the world. And you strike out into the twilight night of the world in order to find these fruits that concentrate magic and then preserve it, because magic's still needed in the world. It's what keeps the beacons aloft, you know, grants you to have spells and all sorts of other wonderful things. So that's the core idea of the game, is you as marmoteers striking out into the Wildernight, coming back. There's festivals and small towns and all sorts of little holidays to celebrate, both within Nim, which is the lit area, and also out in the Wildernight. Like, it's a very cozy game that's also has dangers and stuff. As for the core mechanic, so the core resolution really is you have a set of attributes, and those have dice associated with them. So a d4, a d6, you know, an 8-sided die, whatever it ends up being. And then you also have these other things, whether that's an item or your magic or role-playing feats. So you describe something that you do in role-playing, and a die is associated with how impactful that is. And that's called the impact die. And you take your attribute die or your impact die and you roll it together. And you're trying to basically beat a target number called the difficulty rating. And whether that is the difficulty rating of performing an action or having a conflict with an adversary or overcoming a challenge, those all have different difficulty ratings associated with them. But I think what's really cool is that for like adversaries and challenges, instead of having hit points, what we have is what's called the resolve of the challenge or the resolve of an adversary. And it is the number of successes that you need to have rolled to overcome the thing. So for instance, an adversary might have a difficulty of 8 and then 3 resolve. And so you need to have 3 successes. The cool part is that you can roll multiple successes on a single check. So if you are able to gather enough dice or improve your dice by burning cards and things like that, which we'll get to cards here in a second, you're able to add additional dice to the pool that you're going to roll. And so for something that's a DR8 difficulty, if you roll a 16 or above, it counts as 2 successes. You know, it's multiples of that DR. So it allows you to perform heroic feats and really put together all of your resources into, you know, a mighty roll to do something really cool.
That's cool.
So that's the core.
So kind of like exploding dice, but not quite.
Yeah, not quite. So instead of like exploding dice, is like if you roll a 6, you can roll an additional die.
Yeah.
Whereas how this works is you have, when you roll against the DR, you either have a success or a setback. On a setback, you gain a card into your hand, and then those cards can be burned to give additional impact to your impact dice. So you could say, instead of rolling 1d6, I'm going to roll 2d6, and here's why it's more impactful, right? And you burn a card.
Yeah.
And so we reward setbacks by saying, hey, in the future, you're going to have the resources to really succeed, which I love.
Okay. So, you mentioned a bit, obviously, in how it came about, sort about the theming, but why specifically, though, did you go for jam? Was it just because it was a game jam, or was it for any particular reason?
So, when I was challenged, the challenge was the Drakes and I wanted to both make a game that had the same theme. Because one of the conversations I had with them recently was, you can have the exact same idea, and the way that I'll approach it and the way that they'll approach it will be two very different things, right? And so they were like, you know what? It's a game jam. Let's do something that's jam themed for fun. And they made this really cool dungeon crawler where you collect ingredients to make jams, and those jams have special effects and stuff like that. And so I went in a direction of, it being the core of our magic system. And so everybody carries around, not everybody, but the Marmoteers carry around jam jars that are made of crystallized magic. And so when you put ingredients into your jam jar, it becomes magical. And it has all these different narrative effects and things like that. But yeah, that's where the jam itself came from.
Nice. See, now I was going to ask you about your magic system.
Oh, yes. So,
since we're here, it seems like a good time, right?
Yeah. So, for people that are familiar with the kind of games we make very narrative-based games. We try to empower players to influence the narrative. And so with my magic system, I didn't want to just hand out spells, right? Like, oh, if you have these two ingredients, it equals this spell kind of thing. And so what we did was we have this magic system where you can add up to four ingredients to your jam by burning cards of different suits, right? So there's each ingredient goes into a slot, essentially. You have four slots. And in order to determine what the magical effect is of that jam, is you take the description of the first ingredient and you combine it in some way up to the player with the words of the second ingredient that you're adding. And so how the new spell actually functions is totally up to the player. And their narrative effects. The actual like dice roll, like how powerful the magic is based upon how many ingredients are in it. So it's like, is it a D6 impact die? Is it D8? So on and so forth. That's the number of ingredients. And that really freed us up to say, everything else is narrative. So we don't have to have mechanical rules associated with individual ingredients. We can just say, this creates a fog that obscures vision, right? In a small location. And one of the things you can do with card burning is you can say, I want to increase the narrative aspect of this spell. So instead of it creating a small patch of fog, it's going to create a massive patch of fog. And the more cards you burn at a single time, the more powerful it becomes. So not only are you rolling more dice, but the actual narrative aspect of the spell becomes bigger as well.
Nice.
Which is very, very dynamic, right? And we'll have 52 ingredients to start. Which is just an absolutely crazy number of combinations when you start talking about four. I forget what it is. It's something like 280,000 different combinations is what it comes out to be. But, you know, one of the things that we talk about with our magic system is, and we encourage the GM to help players with this and for other players to help each other with this, is you can take a single word and interpret it in multiple ways. We encourage that. And so one of the things we give is, influences a creature's attitude is one of the things that you can do. So like if they're hostile, maybe they come neutral or friendly, those kind of things. Are there multiple ways to interpret attitude? Or are there multiple ways to, talk about seen through lies or illusions or masking, right? And so we talk about all these different ways to interpret the words and encourage players to do so.
Well, yes, because attitude's also your position. So you could, like, turning background, turn him backwards and upside down so that he's just out of the fight for a minute.
Yep. But yeah, exactly.
That sounds hilarious, honestly.
Yeah, right? And the thing is like, I would not have, and that's what I love about this system, that is because I would not have thought about that. If it was like, I am the one that's writing the spell pieces, right? And I'm like, oh, it influences attitude. And they're like, okay, well, they're really high up in the air now. And you're, and I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, it's the height, it's the attitude. And you're like, oh, right. I love that because I couldn't have thought of anything like that. That's just not where my mind goes. So that's, I love it. I love it.
So did this have any major effect on the world building aspect, or was the world building done somewhat separately to this and then added in, or how did you go about doing that then?
So it was a little combination of both. So the world building was this, I had already had a project going. It was just a creative writing project, had no game associated with it, and I was just writing to write in order to basically get over writer's block and, you know, a creative block. And I just keep, you know, Google documents of scratch space ideas, and I had totally forgotten about it. And I was designing this magic system initially, and then I was like, well, what are people going to do? And I was like, oh, let's call them the Marmiteers. And I kind of want it to be cozy. I don't want this to be a dark game. And I probably about 2 weeks after designing the main game, I was like, this setting is perfect to use this. And the setting really only had like maybe a page written for it, right? It wasn't a lot. I didn't have like towns and cities and maps, and I didn't have all of that. It was just this idea of, you know, the sun shard beacons, and, you know, you had a god that shattered the sun because your ancestors were afraid of the dark, and so they killed the god of night. And so the god of the sun was enraged and said, nope, that's it, and shattered the sun. And, right, like, so there's some background there, right? And that's why we call this cozy dark, because these kinds of themes exist on kind of, like, behind the main facade. And so, like, they're like, yeah, we're going to have a sun shard festival to celebrate the light. And you're like, yeah, but we killed a god like 300 years ago to get this. Is that, where is he at now? You know, is he coming back? That kind of thing. You know, and there's, I don't think I had anything related to like creatures or the society that exists in the Wildernight. Like that didn't exist yet. So all of that was kind of written after this idea of this magic existing for jams.
Nice. So interacting with the world and character building and character builds. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about why the builds work the way they do? How you kind of do that?
So I like people being able to build characters at the table rather quickly. But I also in this game wanted characters to be have a little bit more depth, have a little bit, I don't want to say crunch, because this is not a crunchy game, but there are knobs to dial in for people that are interested in being like, oh, can I do things this way, or can I do things that way? And so character building is, you know, is supposed to be quick, and so we give these backgrounds that give you a bunch of starting stats. Certain stats start higher than others based upon your background, and the backgrounds are wonderful, you know, cozy things like cartographers or a forager or a apiarist, which is, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, a beekeeper. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and they're, and you know, the beekeeper's fully armored against bees, and so they kind of act more like tanks. They have a higher resilience. You know, they're a stout character. And then there's abilities that we grant them. And the abilities, there's one ability that's mechanical and one ability that is social in nature. And that ability is usually a passive thing that you can tap on. You can be like, hey, I have the ability to do this. So in this interaction, right, like interacting with other farmers as the beekeeper, since you are also technically a farmer in some way, if they are guarded of city dwellers, you're able to get past that and actually like befriend them. And so narratively, you can say, hey, I have this feature, I'm going to befriend them. And you don't have to roll forward or anything at that point. But yeah, so it gives people a little bit more. But then there's also like, you can join guilds and you're going to create your first spell based upon the ingredients that you've drawn. And there's styles and quirks to apply to your character, which style gives you some panache, kind of like how you think about the world and how you approach the world. And quirks are these little tics that you might have. You know, are you an overpacker? Do you worry about every, you know, overthink every little detail? Do you hum to yourself constantly and annoy the people around you because you just always have a tune going in your head? So all these little quirks. And I like quirks better than flaws because, you know, obviously it's like, well, playing to your weaknesses is a lot of fun. But quirks are just so enjoyable. Like, humming can absolutely be a flaw if you can't stop yourself and you're in a dark cave and you're trying to sneak around and you're like, well, I have a tune in my head. We've been here for 5 minutes. I can't not hum, right? It's wonderful.
Weight's always a problem, but you always have that thing somewhere in your pack that you need.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, yeah, you're like, oh, you're always weighed down. Like, maybe the GM's like, hey, since you're an overpacker, your pack is really heavy. You're trying to like climb this cliff face. Is that going to be a disadvantage, right? You know, maybe the DR is, you know, +2 from what it would have been in order to have a full success, right? And you know, and we talked to the GM about that in our kind of guidelines, where it's like, if something is, you can increase or decrease the DR based upon these different factors. So we don't have like roll for advantage or disadvantage in like in a traditional game. It is, hey, if you think they would be more impactful, you can reduce the DR to represent that, you know, that going better than expected. It's just to make it easier.
Yeah. Hmm. So you've mentioned kind of cozy dark scenarios. What is the main kind of experience you're wanting people to kind of get from this game? Are you wanting to go down the slightly more maybe horror-y side, or maybe the slightly more cozy side?
Yeah.
What is your ideal kind of experience you'd have people get from this?
So mine would be, so I'm gonna throw out some like existing games as kind of an idea, is this kind of a straddles over the garden wall, and maybe a little Sea of Stars, maybe a little Ghibli, right? So there's these impactful themes, but people are generally seen as good. There might be some horror there, but it's more childlike wonder horror, right? Instead of dark, grisly kind of things. But like one of the things, we're going to have 5 adventures included in the book to kind of really give examples as to the style of play. And so one of them takes place in the Wildernight, and you're out, you're collecting midnight muscadines, but there's conflicts between there's people trying to find shooting stars that have fallen, and you know, we've got glow bears wandering about, and there's Shadows of Tomb, which is the dead god of the night, that are looking for the midnight muscadines as well. And so it is very much a you know, interacting in the dark. You're in a dormant volcano caldera. There's also a witch about who is actually a good person, and it's a traditional almost like OSR-esque adventure, and that is very much like a key adventure that we're going to have. That's going to be the first thing that a lot of people interact with, and so it's, I would say that's kind of key, is this going out into the Wildernight, having this kind of over the garden wall, dark forest, things prowling kind of vibe. Whereas Nim, And this is for people who maybe want a lighter game or a one-shot or things like that. We're going to have a series of mysteries where you can gather clues and you can deduce what the answer is, and it's more free-form kind of gameplay where you're traipsing around and running into villagers, and maybe it's, you know, you're kind of having some silly hijinks going on inside of a town, and there's a festival going on in the background with fireworks shooting up, but you're finding a lost cat and where, you know, what happened, you know, kind of thing. Like one of the mysteries we have is this small town is looking is preparing for a lantern festival to ward off the twilight, and the lanterns are going missing, and so it's this traipse around this town where there's a bustle, you know, small town bustle of preparing for a festival, and you know, the players get to decide how silly or how dark it gets based upon the events. So we give a list of like 12 events, 12 clues, and when they're presented with an event, they can overcome that event in different ways, role-playing and making their checks, and then at that point they go, okay, well, we discover a clue, they roll on the cute clue table, they get a random clue. And at the end, they get to decide, is this, you know, piecing all these clues together, this is what's going on, this is the answer, and now they get to go role-play and figure out. And so, depending on the table, they might say something that's, you know, it's cozy. Oh, it's, you know, this person that's building a lantern monster for the festival, and they're going around, you know, stealing all the lanterns for this thing. Or maybe it's, you know, a wildernight creature is coming in and doesn't want the festival to happen, so they can't ward off the twilight, right? Both are valid. I hope that answers your question. It straddles the line between both.
Yeah. So,
fair play.
I know this is a group tabletop game, but there's also this amazing chapter on solo play.
Yes.
Which, of course, is my near and dear to my heart.
Absolutely.
Yes. So, how did you kind of come up? It seems more a guide than a bunch of extra rules, which you see sometimes in.
Yes.
In these, and how did you determine to do it that way?
So initially I was going to write a chapter on rule adjustments for how to play solo, and what we ended up doing instead is, after the beta release, is we went back to the rules and we made all of the rules player facing. So all of the roles, even in conflicts and challenges and things like that, it is the player themselves doing the roles. They're drawing the cards, they're burning the cards. And since the GM is more, in the traditional style of play, is more just guiding the story, there wasn't any rule adjustments that actually need to be made at that point, right? So what I decided to do, and this was from feedback from my previous game, Substratum Protocol, was there was a lot of people that said, hey, I love that this is solo, but I don't know how to start. I don't know what to do. Like, I understand the rules, but what do I do? And so I decided to dedicate the entire chapter to basically saying, here's how to start. We're going to teach a little bit of narrative theory, so inciting incidents and the three arc story and things like that, to really get people to wrap their head around how to tell their own story. And then we also gave just a huge amount. We do give a core gameplay loop as well, which I'm going to update. There'll be two kind of pieces, right? There's the core loop that's in the book already that, Kim, you've been able to see. And that is, like, how to actually do scenes, right? You describe the world, you go through the scene, you know, you make your check, how do people react? And then there's the game loop as well, which is Marmoteers start in Nim, they prepare themselves, they go out in the Wildernight, they find Midnight Muscadines, they come back, they level up, right? That kind of loop. That I'm going to add in as well. But for actual solo play, we included a bunch of tables, just a huge, huge number of tables. I actually worked with the author of the Soloist newsletter, Patrick, and he wrote a bunch of tables for me for actually solo play. And then we have this really cool system that I've been really wanting to promote more often, and I finally get to build it into a game called Mentor Prompts. And Mentor Prompts is probably the biggest, what I would call, solo rule. And that is a bunch, they're just a, I think they're 20, there's 20 of them, but they're all GM-like actions. So things like introduce a rival, reveal a clue, describe the location, right? Things like that, all things that GMs have to do. And they'll be in our card deck that we're designing, but also a table. And so if you're ever not sure what to do, you draw a card, look up on the table this GM action, and it should prompt you to do something, whatever it is, you know, introduce a new adversary. A rival is, you know, tailing you now, right? That kind of thing. And in the table, we'll give a little short summary of what it means to do that task. But in the solo chapter, we go into quite a bit of detail as to what all of those mean. So that's, like you said, it's more of a guide. But we do provide the tables and the mentor prompts and, you know, the two different gameplay loops. I'm actually really excited about it.
I was really impressed with all of the solo goodness in this, because a lot of the times you'll ask, oh, is this soloable? Yeah. Yeah, there are some tables. And you look it up and you're like, oh, well, I'll grab Mythic and we'll see what we can do.
Yep, that's it. You either grab Mythic or you're just like, I have a lot of footwork that I have to put into this.
No, here, this is going to be one of my recommended starter solo.
Wonderful.
Deals, because there's so much there, and I feel like it's helping people learn the right way to solo, how to use their own, trust their own instincts and their own storytelling to be able to not always rely on Mythic and tables to spark their own imagination.
Absolutely. And part of it is, In our previous games, whenever I've released a lot of solo games at this point, but they're all beginning, middle, and end kind of storytelling, right? There is a very definite create your character, go through this mystery or adventure, and then there's an end and you describe the end. And I wanted this solo to be much more open-ended. What adventure do you want to do? And so, you know, it took me a long time actually to get over that mental process of like, oh, this needs to be a closed loop. Instead of, we've provided a world where they can go on any number of adventures that they want to go on. How do I provide the tools so they can figure out what that is? Honestly, it took a lot of time to change my mentality about that.
Okay, so with it being both multi and solo, how have you written combat and conflict resolution for this system? And how do they differ between the two, if they differ?
Yeah, so we are... So Pandion Games, usually one of the things that makes our games, is that we reduce focus on combat specifically. Normally, and that's why in the game book we actually call it conflict. We call it conflicts and we call it adversaries. And so in this game specifically, because I knew there was going to need to be confrontation with dangerous creatures or dangerous people in this game, especially to make it the dark part, and also for adventures to really be grand in some way, there's got to be this climax usually. But I didn't want to do traditional combat with strategic minis and is there cover and my sword is +2. And so what the conflict exists in here is all adversaries, creatures, folk, whatever it ends up being, has a set of stats. That stat is their difficulty rating, their resolve, and the number of actions they can take when it's their turn. And then they also have abilities. Those abilities usually have a dice rating associated with them, and if they get to take those abilities, that reduces the character's resolve. And the resolve in this case is HP. Interestingly, and this is part of the solo supportiveness, is, and this is where I think some people will, more traditional people that like combat, strategic combat, it'll take a little bit to wrap their head around this, is that when you confront an adversary, you roll your dice, you make your check against them, and on a success, you make a success, you mark that you've, you know, knocked off one of the resolves. Think of it as like a clock, right? You're filling a clock. The resolve is the number of divisions on that clock. So if you have a resolve of 3, you need 3 successes. On a setback, the enemy gets to take their turn, and they get to use a number of actions that's equal to their action stat, and they can take any of their abilities. They can do roleplay feats. So the GM or the player says, you know, they're not going to use any of their abilities. What they're going to do is they're going to go over here and do this rope and untie the rope, and they're going to let a chandelier fall on the player, right? I think that has a D8 die associated with it. You roll your D8, it now does that amount, right? And the dice goes from D4 to D12. So, you know, even a big heavy chandelier might only be a D12. You're not going to get like D20 plus 8 or 6D, you know, you're not going to have that with adversaries. But what that does mean is if you're not engaging the adversary, the adversary doesn't get a turn, all right? Because they're responding to you. It's a reaction to you. And really what your role is your role is saying, I have defended against the adversary and I have taken my action against them, right, at the same time. And on a setback, I did not succeed at overcoming them on this turn. They are taking their action against me, and it won. It won out, right? So it's kind of the role does both. Interestingly, if the adversary is very difficult, say their DR is really high and you're not able to get it and you're just getting setbacks, players can choose to say, I want to put the adversary at a disadvantage, or I want to strike at their weapon in order to make the die rating of that weapon become worse so it doesn't impact me as much, it doesn't hurt me as bad in future setbacks. The GM or the individual player sets the DR for that, just like they would for any other check, and they can see if they succeed at that. And so players do have the ability to say, hey, here's somebody that's a DR 18 adversary. I can only roll a maximum of 12 without burning cards. Instead, I'm going to try to put them at a disadvantage. They come up with how they're going to do that. A DR is assigned to it. They make their roll, and then on success, the DR might drop down from an 18 to a 16, right? So now they do that again on their next one. But on a setback, the adversary still takes their turn, right? So there's still that risk there. So that's combat in a nutshell. And it's popcorn turn, since, generally the enemies or the adversaries are taking their turns when you take your turn. There's no need of like who's going first or anything like that. The only difference is if the adversary initiates, they do get to take their abilities and actions first, and then it goes back to, you know, the players, it being fully player facing.
It does sound very much more encouraging of roleplay then.
It is. Yes, it is very much. Yeah. And that's really what we want to encourage is, you know, there's still risk. There's still the tension and release of like rolling dice. Oh, am I going to hit? I don't have enough. Okay, I'm going to do the DR. I'm going to burn my 3 cards because I want 2 successes on this one. I want to perform a heroic action. But it's more of, you know, talk. What are you doing? What are we, what, you know, and it can be anything, you know. And all items can technically be used. So if you have, you know, a starlit mirror and you say, hey, I want to use this to, you know, go against this adversary, how do you use it? Just tell me how you use it. How are you using it in order to, you know, mitigate this glow bear attack who's charging up their electrical energy against you? How do you use a starlit mirror? And if you describe that to me, you're like, this is how I'm going to use it. And so they can't, you know, that kind of, yes, you get to use that as your impact die roll, right? And then challenges are similar to conflicts. The only difference between a challenge and a conflict is that you're having your resilience whittled away during a conflict. And when your resilience hits zero, this is your HP, something happens. It doesn't necessarily have to be death. It could be that you're captured and dragged away to a den. It could be, you know, you get to decide really what the impact of that conflict is going to be. And the same thing with the adversary as well. You can say, we're in this conflict with the adversary. I'm just trying to get them to run away. I'm just trying to get them to... I just want to capture them so I can question them. And it's still, you work down their resolve, and then once their resolve hits zero, or you've hidden their three resolve, or whatever it is, that outcome happens. So it's not necessarily just death. The difference with challenges is you need to get your number of successes before the number of setbacks. So if a challenge has a DR of 8... and a resolve of 3, and so you need 3 successes to ford the river, you need to get 3 successes as you make your way across in some different way. And each roll, after each roll, you would describe the struggle of making your way across this river. But if you get 3 setbacks before you get those 3 successes, you have failed that challenge, and something catastrophic or something really bad happens. You get caught up in a rock and you start rolling down the river and you take a waterlogged condition and your resilience is reduced by half and you've lost an item, right? Like, those things can compound. And so challenges are the kind of this non-violent, like consequences can still happen, but it's not violence or, you know, defending yourself physically kind of thing. And so the examples we give for challenges is things like, hey, I want to convince this baker to give me a free slice of pie. And they're like, well, okay. And so you would use a role-playing feat or magic or, you know, an item in order to, you know, maybe convince them. But, like, you can enter into social conflict with a challenge. And the outcome is basically the person arguing against you until you have... you know, not made your point further resolve, right? You fail 3 times to convince them, and finally they're like, I'm calling the guards, we're kicking you out, you don't get any pie, I don't want to see you here again, right? Like that kind of thing. Or you're granted pie, which is fantastic. But those challenges can be used for anything environmental as well. So, you know, like I said, fording a river or trying to climb a cliff face or making your way through a blizzard, you know, all sorts of different stuff like that. It can be challenges. And the nice thing is, for simple checks, right? Like, hey, I want to look around the room and see if I can find X. The resolve's 1. So it's just a check. So it's just the DR of 8 or DR of 10. You just roll it once. If you succeed, great. If you don't, you don't. All right, so you can still do that, and it's all the same mechanic.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so I know there's been playtesting going on, you know, because there always is. So what feedback have you gotten from your playtesters?
A lot. Quite a bit of the changes that we've made between the beta and now is feedback from playtesters, feedback from people reading it and asking questions. So that's also a helpful form of feedback, is I'm writing things and then people go, I don't know what you're talking about, or you say this here, but I don't see it where you mentioned that before. And it's like, okay, I need to make that clearer. How abilities work is it was redone from playtesting feedback. We had feedback from actually my editor, along with several players, where we were originally categorizing ingredients into rarity types, and that didn't make sense because some ingredients were powerful but were of lesser rarity, and it was like, oh my gosh, we were gonna have to like figure out how to balance ingredients within rarity types, and it was gonna be this huge headache. And so the feedback basically was like, well, you're already having to do a check, why don't you just let the GM or the player in solo decide how difficult it is to currently look for ingredients, and then just make the ingredient random, rather than, okay, pick an ingredient, it's of this rarity, so it has this DR, and so do you find it or not? Maybe you don't, like, you know. And so then I was able to then create abilities that say, hey, you're actually able to find a specific ingredient, that's your cool ability. Or, you know, narratively allow you to find specific ingredients, and there's still a DR associated with it based upon the situation that you're in. So that all came from player feedback. Magic, the jams, have gone through like 3 iterations from feedback. Just the different ways, like skunking, we haven't even covered that, but like skunking of jams, where there were questions where the people were playing and they're like, so I have unlimited uses? Like, this isn't, it's a jam jar, I should end eventually, right? And so we implemented the mechanic of skunking. So some enemies or one of your setbacks on a failed roll could be that you have to remove an ingredient from your jam because it skunks out and it becomes bad. And so we put that in there from playtesting feedback. But from a general, hopefully that was your question, but yeah, from a general, yeah, like, people playing it, people seem to be very excited about it, which just reinvigorates me as well, because I'm like, yes, okay, this is awesome. We are working, we just recently released the first adventure, which was written by M. Allen Hall, who does all kinds of really amazing OSR adventures for like Mothership and Liminal Horror and all sorts of great stuff. And so we'll probably start working here soon to get people to do like actual plays of them playing through the adventure. Because a lot of plays, playtesting has been, here's the rule set, make your adventure, right? Like, go on an adventure with it, right? And see how it works. But to actually give people some mysteries and some pre-written adventures, to really like dial in as to what it is. I'm really excited for that. But yeah, all sorts of fun stuff.
Now, do you have any fun stories or things that unexpectedly happened while you were playing, or that playtesters have told you stories about? Oh, there we were in the middle of blah blah blah. And...
Oh, I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
So not unexpected. More just there was somebody had posted, they grabbed my game and they played through it and they posted up their character and their character backstory, and I was just like, oh man, this is just so cool. And it was they're like a half wildering folk, half nim person, there's wildering folk in the Wildernight, and they were like, I have a companion, and the companion is this a glass hare, which is one of the creatures we have in the bestiary. And I was like, oh my gosh, we need companion rules.
Yes.
And I just like nerded out for a second, and I reached out to that player and I was like, tell me more about how you used the companion and this and that, so I can, you know, basically write rules for it, because I was like, this is so cool. I've totally forgotten that. Normally we leave those kind of things just for like narrative, like, hey, how do you want to use companions, or if you want companions at all. And I was like, no, this would be really cool to like let people use companions. But it was just this really interesting like mix of things that I had not expected, with like, oh, actually I'm from the Wildernight, but I'm part of the Marmoteers, I'm a liaison, and I was just like, this is so cool. Like, this is not part of the, you know, how we had character building. Like, we never specified you had to be somebody from Nim, but I had never thought about, oh, hey, we're actually a wildering folk that is part of the Marmaduke. I was just like, this is cool. This is really cool.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Like that.
So, what has been some of the best parts and the worst parts of making this game?
Oh, I mean, honestly, I think the best parts was when the magic system finally clicked, because we worked on it for so long. Songs and Sagas, at default, did not have any kind of magic system in it. And so trying to figure out, it was the best part was when we finally nailed in the like, oh, it's narrative. People can combine words. They can take the actual words of the descriptions and they can rearrange the words and take the different ideas. And now whenever I write ingredients, I'm like, let me pick specific words because I think people will interpret them in a cool way. And so writing those ingredients has just been really, really fun. I like writing setting guide. I'm very much a writer at heart. Like, I love writing short stories and stuff like that. So writing the setting guide has been a lot of fun. I think the worst part is getting my ideas to make sense with the system. So, like, on the mechanics side. So I will, like, write something, and I have, like, several of my playtesters give me, like, 3 pages of feedback, because they're like, I'm confused about this. You said this, but I'm not sure. And it's just because my brain gets jumbled itself. I'm like, this is my idea, and I don't know how to explain it, and so I'm explaining it the best I can in the document. And it makes sense to me after I reread it 30 times, right? And then you hand it off to somebody new, and they're like, I don't know what these words mean at all. And you're like, okay, hold on. And then, like, I've had to jump on a phone call with my editor to be like, here's what I'm talking about. He's like, oh, hold on, let me go back and rewrite this on your behalf, because I think I have a way that I can phrase this. And so, like, just getting those ideas across in a way that other people can interpret them has been, you know, I mean, that's part of game design. But it's also been very frustrating for me, because I'm like, I should be able to do this easier. I should be able to represent these ideas easier, and I'm struggling. So that has been frustrating.
That's why we have editors.
That's exactly why we have editors. Always hire an editor. If you're an editor writing something, hire another editor.
Yes.
You have to. It can't be yourself.
Okay.
It was good to get another pair of eyes on it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that you talked about some of the things like Ghibli and mm-hmm. Is there anything else, books or specific movies or even other games that you used as inspiration?
Absolutely. So one of the core inspirations I used was Lightfall, The Girl and the Galdurian, which is a visual novel, and it is absolutely one of my favorite books. Beautifully, beautifully illustrated. It's actually where the core idea of, like, this world with a shattered sun initiated, because that's the book takes place in a world like that, and it also has these kind of like cozy vibes to it. I don't know how well known the book is, but I highly recommend everybody go out and buy it and read it. It's absolutely fantastic. So there's that. There's Ghibli. Honestly, and this, there's a game out there called The Dungeons of Hinterberg, which is this really amazing dungeon crawling game, kind of. But you're out on a holiday in the modern world. You're in the Alps, and you're in this little mountain town, and you're a tourist who has come to delve their new magical dungeons that have appeared in the Alps. And so it's this really interesting interplay of, like, oh, well, there's modern society, and, you know, there's an outfitter store, and they're outfitting, you know, heroes, right, to go out into these dungeons. There's a leaderboard, right? You get badges for each dungeon you complete, and so the goal is to complete all 20. So it's, like, modern, and there's celebrities that are doing, like, podcasts and newsreels, you know, in order to gain, you know, status. But then you go out to where the dungeons are, and it's dungeons. It's, you know, magical goblins and things like that that you're fighting off. And it is really cool concept. And part of that is this, where I got the idea of like, okay, you're in Nim, and it's this a little modern-esque town, you know, towns, and it's super cozy, and you can go buy stuff, and you have festivals, and it's fun. And then you go out to where there's dangers and monsters and creatures, and, you know, a lot of that stemmed from this concept of like, oh, you're out on holiday. It's cool. So
that's,
yeah, that's
awesome.
Yeah, so I think besides Sea of Stars, which is very much like colorful, beautiful interplay of like magic and towns, and Sea of Stars is an amazing video game. And then Ghibli is, of course, like Nausicaä and Valley of the Wind and waning magic, and, you know, the ripples of our ancestors' actions and stuff like that. You know, all of that occurring. You know, Princess Mononoke about, you know, the new industry moving in and the magic, you know, being pushed out and the conflict between the two. There's a lot of that in the setting. But Lightfall and Dungeons of Hinterberg are two very cool things to go look up. Highly recommend.
I have just looked up Lightfall. It does look beautiful.
Oh, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. There's three books out right now. I cannot wait for any more that he wants to produce. All of them. I'll buy all of them.
So, how are you planning on releasing this game? Are you kickstarting? Are you backer kitting? What's the way you're going to do this?
Yeah, so we're going to run a backer kit campaign. That will pretty much allow us to, you know, we've already got some of the game produced, obviously. But that's going to allow us to finish up the artwork, editing. I'm paying writers to actually write adventures. I'm having them come in and do that. I want to put together, you know, get it to print. I want to put a little box set together with a custom deck of cards and some custom dice. And the custom deck of cards will actually represent, will actually have your solo tables on them. So instead of referencing the book and the tables each time, you can just draw cards. Not only will it say, like, you know, it's a, you know, three of diamonds, it'll say, here's your mentor prompt, here's your encounter, here's this, here's that, here's, you know, all sorts of things. I think we have something like 12 data points that you can reference on there at any given time. So you're like, I need a theme, I need an item, I need, you know, you just draw the card and you look at the thing that you're wanting and it'll be there. So that's what we're doing with the deck of cards. And obviously, in order to produce that, you know, we've got to go off to manufacturing. So backer kit will allow us to do that. And that launches on April 15th. And anybody can go sign up for the page now at pandiangames.com/muscadines or pandiangames.com/backerkit, whichever is easiest for you to spell. Because I know a lot of people don't know what muscadines are, which are grapes. They're delicious, but they're native to the Southeast. So.
I had no idea what that was until you just said it.
Yeah. Oh, man. If you ever can get a hold of some muscadine wine or some whole pie made with muscadines, they're not well sold outside of the Southeast of the U.S., but they're these big, giant grapes with super, super thick skins. They're usually dark purple with little flecks in them. They remind me of galaxies, which is why I was like, magic. There's magic in them. But what's crazy is their skin is so thick that in order to eat them, you normally just bite onto the skin in order to pull, like, to bite into just a little bit to make a hole, and then you can essentially suck the grape out, because the skins are so thick. They're cool. They're really good, too. They're like this sweet, super tart. Anyway, I can go, I love muscadine.
It's awesome. Okay, so going forward, you said that you've got writers working on on adventures for the game. Yep. Beyond the backer kit and all of that, do you intend to do expansions and updates down the road too?
Yeah. So I hope to work on this game for a while after release. So I want to do... I don't want to promise any expansions right now, but I do want to do more adventures. I have a campaign idea, actually, in the back of my mind that I'm slowly writing notes for. And, like, one of the expansions I would love to do is, like, tea and tinctures, which is taking the idea of magical jams and allowing people to, like, brew teas and other little potions to have, not necessarily magical effects, but take all of these ingredients that we have and use them in different ways. And expand the ingredients list as well at the same time. But there are a bunch of really cool things in the world that I'd love to explore, that I don't think we're going to be able to really do justice in, you know, without expanding the adventures and the game and things like that. Like, we have this concept of the tapestry existing underneath the world, and the tapestry is the interconnecting realms. So you have Song and Dusk, right? It's all going to be related to Night and Dark and all that fun stuff. But, you know, the world of ghosts and the ether and things like that all exist within this world. And that's separate from harvesting muscadines, but yeah, it does exist. There might be reasons or ways that you can interact with it, but I would love to explore that more.
That sounds a little like Weave World, which is an older novel by Clive Barker. That the world is a tapestry, and it's all knots and threads, and somebody is messing with it.
Oh,
and
nice.
They're undoing people and changing things. Yeah.
I will have to look into that. One of the things that inspired it on my side was the old LucasArts game called Loom, which is an old point-and-click adventure game from, I think, 93? I love old adventure games.
That was cool.
Yeah. Loom is an inspiration for that. Also Riven. So spoiler alert for Riven. But yeah, the Through the Fissure, right? The Starry Expanse.
Oh yeah.
Like, that is such a cool visual concept for me. So those two inspired the tapestry. I'm gonna look up Weave World though. It seems really cool.
It's delightful.
Clive Barker. Yeah, sorry, I've got it up. Yeah.
So, one of the last things we usually ask is, what advice would you give to any aspiring TTRPG creator out there?
Oh. Get it out in the world. I think that's the biggest thing, is don't worry about making it perfect, especially your first or second game. I think it's more important to write something you're passionate about and put it up on itch.io, put it out on DTRPG, get people, you know, seeing it and interacting with it. And when you learn more, you can go back to it and update it. That's totally fine. I've updated my games 3 or 4 times, especially my older games. But getting it out there, that act of finishing something and getting it up on whatever storefront you want, you know, I'm a big fan of itch.io because it's just easy and it's wonderful. And talking to people about it and getting people to look at it and play it and review it, and you know, that will get you going and have you learn a lot about TTRPGs in general.
Nice. So where can people find you?
So we're pretty much everywhere. So we're Pandion Games on Blue Sky. You can find us at pandiongames.com. That's our store and website. You can find us on pandiongames.itch.io as well for our digital games. And pretty much everywhere is Pandion Games. So Discord is Pandion Games, and Threads, we're also on Threads. And Substack, pandiongames.substack.com for our newsletter. So yeah, you can find us just about everywhere.
That's awesome. Now, this was not the first time I'd heard of Pandion Games. The first time I heard about it was from another creator, James from Crumbling Keep Marching Order. Okay. And he was going on about the year dungeon journal.
Oh, the dungeon that... year journal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I kind of wanted to give a shout out to that because that's how I initially heard of your company.
Yeah, nice. Okay. So, and that started as a community project. So there, it was part of Dungeon 23, which is this like build a dungeon one day at a time. And I was like, well, what if we had a journal where you had 365 day entries? And we really, it's still for the digital version, still free everywhere. It's print and use kind of thing. And so we made that and we released it. And then we also were like, well, I'd like to have a physical journal of it. And so we took it to print. And it's still being sold today, and it's not tied to any one year, which was super important. And you can pick it up at any time of the year, and there's 365 checkboxes, right? So it's like, okay, well, you can start. You don't have to start it on January 1 kind of thing. And then it's also gotten picked up by the solo community. And the solo community is using it to, like, play games and, like, detail their world and do the world building for their game. And I thought that was just so, so cool. And so that's, you know, that's being picked up a lot for that. And I have a goal this year to update the journal with feedback from solo players. So it can be used for the dungeon year and also for solo play. And well, it's already being used for that, but taking in all of that feedback and make it even better for solo players.
Yeah. Because I mean, that's what the people that I've talked to are using it for. They are making giant mega dungeons or mapping their world with it and then playing the heck out of it.
Yeah, it's so cool. I love seeing people will post up on like Threads and Blue Sky with what, you know, their day entries. And it's so cool to see that. I love seeing people create stuff.
Too. It's exciting. Creators amaze me. We are so grateful for them, and we're super grateful for you coming today again because you're so busy.
And... No.
Thank you.
No, I am so happy to be here. Truly, this has been a lot of fun.
I've had a really good time too.
Yeah.
Same here.
Thank you. Yeah, I very much appreciate it, and I appreciate you all taking your time as well.
All in days work. It's good to get the voice of creators out there and get the understanding behind their games and just more information about it so people can kind of listen to it and go, oh, you know what, that sounds like it's for me. And they can go off and support it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can tell you, all of us creators very much appreciate that because sometimes we don't even know how to, you know, find and get our word out there that our, you know, any of our stuff exists. So we very much appreciate you guys taking the time.
Right, I think we'll wrap that up right there. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And to anyone listening, go and find this game. Links will be in the description below. Goodbye.
Bye.
So long.